everyone, it's been a while since we've done this. Let's blame the tennis, and let's blame Glastonbury, and well, let's blame anyone but ourselves, really. It's not that we've been too busy, it's that there's been so much else to entertain us. But F1 has not stopped in our absence.
What has been going on? Where do you start?
It's not been boring. There's been news and headlines and conspiracies and controversies and races and then non-races because there's breaks and back-to-backs. And oh, how far do you think we can get into this show without talking about tyres?
I don't think you can start this show without talking about tyres.
You think we're going to dive straight in?
I think it's the important, it's the discussion, it's the story of the year. It has already dominated the first third, or perhaps more of the season, probably the first half of the season has been dominated by tyres. The argument and the discussion and the debate isn't going to go away. It's going to roll and roll and roll. So let's not try and fight that. Let's just dive right in and discuss tyres. Where are we and what are you thinking on the whole Pirelli situation?
Well, where we are is heading straight into a young driver test, or as I like to call it, a driver test.
As it should have always been named,
just
really.
A test. It's going to include the regular drivers after the Pirelli chaos that was Silverstone. Millions of tyre blow-ups, very dangerous race. They probably should have red flagged it at some point, but they didn't. And now it feels like that is all overkill because in Germany, it was all fine.
So we're talking, let's discuss. So first things first, Pirelli and analysed the situation, the experience in Silverstone, and they concluded that it wasn't their fault. There was nothing to do with them, and it was all the teams.
No, that's not true, because Paul Hembree issued a statement saying he wasn't trying to blame anyone. He's had lots of support from the FIA and from drivers and from teams. It wasn't no finger pointing going on at all, except for the fact that the teams run the tyres at the wrong temperatures. They run them the wrong way around, and they run the wrong camber levels, or whatever you measure that in. But apart from that, it is not their fault at all. It's everyone's fault.
It's everyone else's fault. I think Pirelli blamed, they may have suggested that the curbs at Silverstone were perhaps a fraction more aggressive and sharper than they would have liked, but the rest of it was the team's fault.
Yeah, and curbs, not Pirelli's fault. Everything the teams did wrong, not Pirelli's fault. There's a pattern there, I think.
I do feel sorry for Pirelli because I have, I've liked everything they've done in Formula One up until the point when the tyres started attacking other drivers at Silverstone. And poor Fernando Alonso got a full face of it. I mean, it was nearly a very serious accident with him following whatever car it was at the time. I think it was Perez he was going to pass when his tyre gave up. But until that point, I really was behind Pirelli. And I still am behind Pirelli. And they are correct. The teams are always pushing to find the most advantage they can out of the tyres and running them under pressure. Running them more incredibly aggressively to get the most performance out of them is what they've done. Is what they do. Is what they've done for a long time. We've talked on the show previously about the aggressive camber angle of the Red Bulls. Their tyres essentially looks like they're running at 33 degrees wherever they're running on track. The tyres look like they're running flat. You could be forgiven for thinking that car's got a puncture, but no, you know its tyres have been filled to too low a pressure in order to get the most performance out of it. And unfortunately, Pirelli's structure and design, which makes tyres degrade at an aggressive level, is not prepared to deal with these these kind of settings and these setups.
Yeah, but the trouble that we have is everyone's saying, oh, Pirelli, 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 it's all too much about Pirelli and tyres and I'm fed up of tyres and everything. But there's sort of different problems, because for the first few races, it was all about how they are upsetting the strategies too much and dominating the racing action. Now it's because they weren't safe. And then the latest race in Germany, it's because they go flying everywhere. And it's like there's three separate problems, but they all roll into one massive, yes, we hate Pirelli problem.
Yes. It's, to be honest with you, a lot of it is sadly been foreseeable. If you take the situation that Red Bull had in the pit lane in Germany when a wheel came flying off of Mark Webber's car and struck an unfortunate FIA cameraman, it's entirely the product of the fact that pit stops have become too fast. And we've been complaining about that for so long that Formula One pit stops are now,
as reported by Side Podcast,
as complained about by Christine on many occasions.
Oh, yes.
You have been saying that the, you know, these tyre stops are are embarrassing. Since refueling was taken away, they happen too quickly. It's over within a split second. They are effectively pointless. There's no reason for them to be that quick. There's no reason for a Formula One team to have 30 personnel crowded around a car when it comes in for a pit stop. We watched Le Mans a couple of weeks ago. They have, I think, two personnel per side of the car. So they've got four people in a pit stop. And that works out great. You know, they've got, you can, your car comes in, you can see everything that's happening because you can keep an eye on that smaller number of people. You can watch the wheels come off. You can watch the wheels go on. It's very, very clear when there's a problem, when there's, you know, there's so much space and time around a pit stop. It's very easy to see when a wheel's not on correctly. And if a guy's struggling with his side of the car, Formula One doesn't seem to see that as a logical and sensible way to approach it. So they just pile on with as many people as you could possibly get into a tiny little space. And then the person who's working the lollipop or the pit lights, how can you can't see, you know, you can't look at this, you can't survey the situation and say, well, now that it's safe for the car to go.
You have to look at four corners at once and look at what's coming down the pit lane and know what's going on behind you and know where everyone is. And there's a lot of information to take in.
Well, it is. It's impossible. It's an impossible situation to be in. But it's also the same for fans. It's insane for us to sit there and analyse what happens at pit stop. It's just like, guys come on, guys disappear, and the car goes away again. And what happened? You cannot consume that much and digest and, you know, analyse that much information that quickly. It is utterly pointless. And when things happen so quickly, mistakes are bound to happen. And when mistakes happen, people get hurt.
So we've had what could have been an overreaction by the FIA for the Silverstone thing by turning the young driver test into a driver test. Mm-hmm. And now we've had another overreaction where first Bernie banned his camera people mm-hmm. from the pit lane. And now the FIA have banned any personnel ever, basically. Yes. Any media. No one is allowed in the pit lane unless they're physically working on the cars. In any session.
Don't even look at the pit lane. Don't even think that the pit lane is there anymore. You won't be able to see it. You won't know what's going on. No one should even be. It's of no one's business that there is a pit lane with cars in it from now on. That's essentially what the FIA is saying. Forget that it's there.
And there were two people on Twitter who I thought summed it up best. Will Buxton was very outspoken about it because obviously he covers the practice sessions, and he said, "We don't get garage access, so information gathering in practice sessions will rely on teams upping their PR game hugely. If a mechanic, engineer, team boss, FIA scrutiny, or doctor had been hit by a tyre, would that profession now be banned from the pit lane?" And Jonathan Noble of Autosport said, "Am I alone in thinking it shouldn't be about removing people from the path of wheels? F1 needs to stop wheels coming off in the first place."
Well, yes, by putting them on correctly in the first place, by having time to put them on correctly in the first place.
I can understand cutting down the number of people in the pit lane for the moment until they sort out the problem. But I also don't think it needs to be every session, because racing pit stops happen in a race and perhaps in qualifying. But in practice, they don't really do that.
There is a period when teams will practice racing pit stops before, usually happens on a Thursday. There are various times throughout the weekend when a team will have time to run through racing pit stops. But aside from in the dying moments of qualifying and in the race, that is the only time when danger is at its highest. What's lost on me is Mark Webber's rear right tyre came off. And so that tyre went bouncing down the pit lane on the right hand side. So Bernie said, okay, well, we're going to take all our camera crew and we're going to put them on the pit wall on the left, which is absolutely fine until a left side wheel comes loose.
Yeah.
And where's that wheel going to go? Directly in the path of where the cameramen are now standing. Everything that's happened since the FIA guy got taken down by that wheel has been a disaster of overreaction and short-term thinking. And it seems like people are, I mean, the reaction is to, essentially everybody's looked at one single incident of what happened to one tyre and decided and made all their decisions based on that. We saw, was it 2 years ago in Hungary, when a wheel went loose and it bounced over the media centre window, over the canopy outside the window. So effectively people in the media centre saw the tyre bounce past their window.
Yeah.
When a tyre is that loose and effectively sailing at that speed and that distance, nothing you do, nowhere you stand, nowhere you position people will be safe, because with that kind of velocity and that kind of aggression from such a heavy object, it's got to stop somewhere. I think last time it was one of the Williams pit crew caught it, or effectively stopped it in his tracks, and he was a big guy and he got injured.
Yeah.
And so it has to hit something, it has to stop somewhere. So, you know, it doesn't matter where you put people, they're going to get caught. They're going to be in the line of fire. The way to prevent this from happening, I think there was a discussion on Twitter, which is by far and away the only sensible conversation I've seen about this. And that was to suggest that in the pit lane, why doesn't the ECU, I think Will, who's in the comments at the moment, suggested this, and Stephen and perhaps Chainbear. There was a discussion between three or four people. And it's their idea was a stroke of genius. And that is, you have a single supplier ECU in every single Formula One car. You can control the torque and the speed of on the spin-up of the tyres. So when the car is in the pit lane, restrict what happens to the gearbox, you know, restrict what the gearbox is doing, and then the tires won't be able to spin up at such a speed. Send the car down the pit lane at a slow speed, and then you're in control of what the tires are doing.
The two things that the FIA have done that is sensible but was coming in anyway, they brought forward regulations that everyone involved in a pit stop has to wear a helmet, which I thought was regulation anyway, and they've brought forward the speed limit drop in the pit lane so that it's going to be 80 kilometers an hour across every session instead of 100 in the race and 80 in practice, or whichever way around it was. But I wonder if it shouldn't be, because it's 60 kilometers in Monaco, because it's tighter in there,
smaller,
I guess.
Much smaller,
I think it just should be one slow speed limit everywhere, every session, every circuit you go to, because then people don't have to remember what they've got to do.
It would be constant, so that if you got used to cars coming in at a certain speed and leaving a certain speed, it would be good to have one fixed limit throughout the whole season. And I don't see why, you're correct, there should be, there's no reason why it should vary. But interestingly, neither of those regulations that the FIA have brought forward early actually would have made any difference at all to the accident that happened at the weekend. Wouldn't make the blindest bit of difference. So effectively, they're taking this situation and they're using it as an excuse to bring these rules in early. But what they're really doing is they are seem to be doing something, but not really solving the problem at all. It's like, yay, we've done this, and everyone goes, oh, that's really good, FIA, well done. What have you solved? What problem have you actually resolved with these changes?
Most of the pit crews wear helmets anyway, and all the Renault people that were directly in the path of the tyre, they jumped out the way. So
Lotus people.
Yes. Lotus, Renault.
Yep.
They all jumped out the way. So having a helmet is not really, doesn't make any difference.
The wheel hit the cameraman on the right, the rear of his right shoulder, and sent him, thankfully, and at an angle whereby I think his left shoulder hit the ground first, which meant he could protect his head. If the wheel had whacked him on the head, fair enough, that would have been a serious injury, and it would have made a significant difference to him. However, I'm not entirely sure that you cameramen can wear helmets and continue to do their job, because the shape and placement of a helmet prevents you from holding a camera and looking into a viewfinder. And I think you'll find no matter which race series you look at in any category that's covered by television, all of the pit lane camera crew have to be helmetless because they can't do their job with a helmet. So the only real option the FIA guy would have had, if you had a second spotter who basically had his back, who was looking in the other direction, could have pulled him aside. That would have helped in that situation. So having two crew per camera would be useful.
But that's more people in the pit lane, and we don't want anyone in there.
Nobody go in that pit lane. I don't know what you're thinking. Mr. C, you're crazy. However, so helmets on FIA cameramen may not even be possible in the pit lane, because I don't think they could do their job.
The tyres will be under investigation again. This week, this coming week at Silverstone for the driver test, there's only really two interesting things I've seen about this so far. Firstly, that Mercedes are not taking part, and they've accepted they can't take part because obviously they were banned for the whole secret testing thing. But it just seems slightly unfair that the punishment is different from when it was first handed out, because the other people are running their current drivers.
Mercedes were banned from a young driver's test, and then the test was changed to be an F1 test.
Yeah, it's still a fitting punishment because they got to run with their current drivers and now they don't get to. But it just seems unfair that that isn't what they agreed to. They might have protested that if it was that at the time.
Sadly for Mercedes, it's worse for them than ever, because with the Pirelli restrictions that came in at the last race, that hurt them more than anybody else in the pit lane. The fact that the teams could no longer swap the left tyre with the right tyre, that was one of the ways that Mercedes have recently managed to get on top of their tyre woes. I mean, their cars have had a habit of chewing through the rubber. And in the last couple of races, Mercedes have found that swapping them over does give them that performance advantage. Now they can't swap them over. They're back to where they were, effectively. And we saw in Germany, they started well, but they dropped down the order. Until
Or they didn't start well in some cases.
Nico?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't qualify well, unfortunately. No. That was a poor strategy call by Ross Brawn. Unusual. But yeah, okay, so Mercedes, Nico Rosberg was out of position.
They went backwards in the race.
They
anyway.
Did. Well, they didn't go backwards. They went backwards in the first half of the race until their cars drained themselves of fuel. And once the cars were lighter, then they went forward again.
Right.
And effectively, that's what you saw. Lewis Hamilton, beginning of the race, he just lost places from the first corner. And halfway through the race, he was complaining that the car was basically undrivable and he felt like he was on different tyres to everybody else. And
Lewis Radio. It's so much fun.
Oh, it's so entertaining. So essentially, halfway through the race, the guy was really struggling. He was out of position and looked like he dropped down the order. But then, in the very latter stages, he managed to mount something of a fight back because his car was light. It wasn't chewing up the tyres. The temperature dropped a little because obviously the sun went down. And then the Mercedes came back into their own. So on a hot day with a heavy car, they still got these tyre problems, which have been exacerbated by the Pirelli restrictions, and now they don't get to test. And so they still can't get on top of these new issues, and Pirelli are bringing new specifications for everybody to take a look at, and Mercedes will miss out on that. And there is, to my mind, still a question mark over whether that's safe for one team to turn up at the next race not having even looked at this brand new specification of tyre, whereas everybody else will have run it and got on top of it. You can have two drivers out there who it's the first time on them.
Yeah, in the comments, I think it was Bassano who said that it was Pirelli that needed the safety information and not the teams. But if everyone else has had a go and just Lewis and Nico haven't, that does seem to be a significant disadvantage and perhaps a safety issue.
Yes, one thing to note is I did catch, I've only caught a fraction of who's driving next week, but Hülkenberg for Sauber is only doing half a day because the teams can, although they can run their race drivers, they can only run their race drivers for tyre development. So Sauber are actually saying, we'd rather work on new components. We'd rather work on things for the future, the rest of the season. So they're not so fussed about the tyre changes. They're confident that Hülkenberg can just suss it in an afternoon and they'll go back to running their third drivers who don't have a huge amount of experience. So either side were genuinely running this as a young driver test, or more likely they have new components and new aero stuff to really get on with, and that's what they're focused on.
Yeah, and they've also got Robin Frins in the car and someone who I haven't heard of, but it's called Kimiya Sato. Now that is Kimi and Sato in the same name, which just means it must be awesome.
Sato's coming back to Formula One.
Sato is.
That could actually be interesting. Watch out for Honda power then. I'm assuming that Sato is Japanese, without ever seeing him or have even heard of him. Sauber might be playing the Honda card because they don't have a secure engine deal long term. They've got Ferrari power. I forget how long their deal is, but it's only for a short period of time. They could extend that, or they could be trying to coax a certain Japanese engine manufacturer their way.
They need all the help they can get at the moment. But the other team that I think have confirmed are Lotus, who have Nicholas Prost, David Valsecchi, and Kimi Raikkonen, who is doing work on Friday. So he's just doing one day. I can't believe they persuaded Raikkonen to do some testing. He doesn't do that, does he?
We saw Kimi Raikkonen at a test. We have photographic evidence of a young Kimi Raikkonen taking part in testing at Silverstone once. So he has done it before. Maybe he's obviously taking this world championship seriously. He's in with an outside chance.
He's in with a mathematical chance.
And maybe that to him, that makes a lot of sense. Personally, I think if I were Lotus, I'd be running Grosjean as much as I could just to give him as much track time as possible.
Well, yeah, but then if he breaks the car, they've got nothing it. To...
He had such a good race in Germany.
Yeah,
did he not win, did he not win your heart back?
It is too little, too late. I supported him for months when everyone told me he was rubbish. I tried, I really did. But no, it's too late. He's gone. He's
not
over.
A man who likes street circuits. Put him on an open racetrack with loads of runoff, like Silverstone or Germany, and he's fine. And he did really well. Unfortunately, probably should have relinquished his position to Kimi a lap or two earlier, and then Kimi might have had a fighting chance to take the race win to Vettel. But bless Grosjean for giving it his best shot. And, you know, he's on the guy's on the podium. You can't, you know, it's more than Massa was.
Oh, poor Massa.
Poor Massa, nothing. He threw away a brilliant start. That's two races in a row. The last race, best start of his career at Silverstone. That was thrown away by tyre damage, not his fault. This race, again, was he in front of Fernando Alonso? He was.
Yeah, well, they didn't try really hard in qualifying, to be fair.
Mm.
So he did qualify ahead of Alonso, for all that is worth.
He had a good start.
He made it four laps, I think.
Yes, before he threw it off the road.
Mm.
Useless.
Which brings us, actually, on to another subject. The questions are raised again. How long has Massa got left in the car in Formula One generally? Ferrari have leapt to his defence.
For the first time in a long time.
It's interesting that they have proactively come out and said that. They support him in his efforts. but there could be a seat at Ferrari going spare soon. We've been talking about this for years and it never occurs, but one day it's going to have to. And we know that there's a seat at Red Bull because Mark Webber is leaving.
He is.
He's retiring from Formula One.
Are we sad about that? I think we're sad about that.
You know, when it first was announced, it didn't really hit me. I just thought, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, he's had a good time. There's not really anywhere else he'd want to go. He's not friends with Red Bull anymore. Makes perfect sense.
No, he is friends with Red Bull. He's not friends with Horner. Yeah. And he's not friends with Sebastian Vettel, but he's still friends with Red Bull.
But I was doing something later. I can't remember results or rankings or something. And I thought, oh, Mark's not going to be in it anymore. That is sad.
I'm going to miss his quotes. I'm going to miss his take on Formula One.
Just generally a good guy.
Yeah. The one thing you've got against Mark Webber is he has been taking up a prime seat for a heck of a long time. And there are arguably more deserving drivers who should be in that Red Bull number two seat. And Mark Webber has been, he's been hogging it. Same way that Massa's been hogging the number two Ferrari seat.
Yeah, but there's potentially those two massive seats going to be freed up quite soon. Who would want to drive them? I just can't see anything attractive about either of those race seats, because there was a time when everyone wanted to be in the Ferrari. And I think when Alonso moved, he was like, it's every driver's dream to go to Ferrari. But I can't see that it is anymore, because they're not that fast and they haven't been fast for ages, and you're going to be number two to Alonso. What is there?
Well, there's still a chance. I mean, Mark Webber won however many, was it nine races? I mean, it was a pathetically low number given the car that he was in, but he still won races, which is more than, say, Nico Hülkenberg has done. And it's more than Paul de Rester has done at this point in his career. And so you would take, if you were a young guy with a good period of your career ahead of you and you have no race wins to your name yet, I think they would take a number two seat. I could see either of those two being very keen to take Webber's spot, because Sebastian Vettel's only extended his contract for one additional year, so you don't know where he's going to go, and you could slot into the number one position. But at the same time, it is kind of a poison chalice that those drives, because you're not going to be a world champion whilst Sebastian Vettel's in the number one car, or whilst Fernando Alonso is in the number one car.
Yeah, to me, a guaranteed number two seat is only attractive to brand new people who don't have anything to lose and need all the experience they can get. Or it's attractive to people that don't have anywhere else to go. Mark Webber style, Felipe Massa style. Mm. The only place they have to go is backwards. So I can't see that someone who, it's like their career is right on the precipice of something.
Yes.
It's a very difficult move to make.
Yes, it is. Unless you look at Fernando Alonso. I mean, there was a fine article by Adam Barton on Monday, and he raised an interesting point. And that was, is Fernando Alonso losing his touch? Because in a sub-optimal car, Fernando Alonso will always get the very best out of it. And yet, twice, Felipe Massa's got more out of it than Alonso. So is he having some kind of career dip, or is his career on the slide? Is it just a blip? Is Massa just managing to out-qualify? Is he got the better of this car? Is the car more to Massa's liking? Or would you look at Fernando Alonso and go, he's getting on a bit, and at some point he's going to need to be replaced, and therefore I'll slot myself into the second position and just bide my time?
Yeah, you've got to be patient and willing to risk that you don't quite know what's going to happen. It's a bit like chess, isn't it?
Really? It is. Well, the driver market is like that.
Chess game.
One other thing I would say is there is a tiny chance that Ferrari might actually want to keep Felipe Massa. And that is the fact that he's done reasonably well against Alonso thus far. Also, you've got a whole bunch of changes coming next year. So stability is key. Red Bull definitely do not have stability going into 2014. And so if you want to play that card, then Massa's a guy you want to keep around.
So there are a few potential drivers who could replace Webber at Red Bull, but the big headlines are surrounding the Toro Rosso duo, because they are obviously in the sister team and directly in line, you would think. Daniel Ricciardo, he's been doing pretty well recently. He qualified well for the last two races. Didn't work out so well for him in Germany, but he's stepped up his game, and he says that the pressure of being potentially in line for a seat is helping him out. Vern, not so much. He also qualified well, did quite well at Silverstone, but it all went wrong again in Germany.
You've got to keep in mind that Ricciardo has, was it 6 months additional experience to Vern? Because he trolled around in the HRT.
Yeah.
Which counts for something. Vern has never really been on top of qualifying.
That's the thing. Though all those qualifying sessions where he was out in Q1, I just think that is going to count against him. Mm-hmm. It counts against him in my head anyway.
Well, here's the most interesting thing for me. It's not which driver will go to Red Bull. If one of them goes to Red Bull, the big question is, what happens to the person who gets left behind? So if you are overlooked for such a key drive, does that demotivate you? Do you think, well, okay, that guy, he may get found out, and he may not last more than a year, so therefore you try harder. Do Toro Rosso say, well, you clearly weren't good enough for the Red Bull seat, so you can move along now? Do they have two people to bring into the... Is there two people in the young driver program who can slot into the Toro Rosso seat? Because in the last time we saw them, they dropped Buemi, and they also dropped Alguersuari at the same time, but they kept Buemi on as a test driver, so he's around if they wanted to bring him back. There's a lot of changes to come in Toro Rosso if one of the drivers moves up, and that's of most interest to me, because if you're the guy who's left behind, then what do you do then?
Yeah, I can see that Vern would probably deal with it. I don't think Ricciardo would deal with that very well at all.
Interesting.
If he got left behind. Because he's so smiley, and I just think he wouldn't be smiling after that. But interestingly, Vern is actually above Ricciardo in the championship, which I wouldn't have expected. I don't understand how that's happened, but that is the way it is.
Because he's a better race driver. Vern has better racecraft than Ricciardo, and he's shown it time and time again. The only problem is he starts farther back almost every single time. And to end up in front of him shows how good his racecraft really is. But qualifying is such an Achilles heel for him. He's just got to get better over one lap.
I think it's worth having a quick look at how the championships stand at this point in the season, because obviously we've missed about, 10 races in our big podcasting.
Let's just pretend the first quarter of the season didn't happen.
Yeah. So Vettel is leading. That's a surprise. He's leading massively, although we did have a glimpse of hope at Silverstone when he had some bad luck. Bad luck for Vettel. That never happens.
It's incredible that, because he got away with the luckiest of the luckiest tyre escapes. He had a cut in his rear tyre. The team happened to bring him in. They didn't know there was anything wrong with the tyre. They brought him in. He got away with that. And then, unbelievably, he suffered gearbox troubles. And that was a huge surprise, because when there's luck going around, Vettel's usually on the receiving end of it. And unfortunately for him, he didn't manage to finish that race. But fortunately for us, it did close up the championship. And it would only take one more incident like that. And you're back, everyone's back on a level playing field. So he's not completely running away with it yet.
No, it's the gap is 34 points to Alonso, which is not unassailable, but it is a whole race win ahead, and it takes a lot to get a race win over and above anything that Vettel
yes.
gets.
Yep.
And then Kimi is behind Alonso, so he's also in the hunt. And in the team standings, that's where things get slightly more interesting, because Red Bull lead massively again. Mercedes and Ferrari, they are neck and neck. They have 3 points between them. It's so close.
Yes.
It's really...
Well, Ferrari have fallen off the pace, but Mercedes are suffering more with these tyres. Now, Ferrari have 3 days to extend their advantage over Mercedes. And so, yeah, the smart money has to back them, because they must find some performance at Silverstone. Unless it's a complete washout. I haven't actually looked ahead to see what the weather's like, but it could be. You know, it's Britain. We're in the middle of a heatwave. It's guaranteed next week is going to absolutely pour down.
Yeah.
So you may find that nobody learns anything, and Mercedes, have no net loss from missing out on these tests. But if Ferrari have 3 clear days and they manage to eke out some new performance from their package, then I would expect them to leave Mercedes in the dust, especially with if the next couple of races are hot. Because Ferrari work really well in warm temperatures, and Mercedes struggle.
McLaren are 6th behind Force India. They've got just 49 points. This is such a poor season for them. Mm. I think probably the last time we were doing a show, we said, yeah, they'll be turning it around soon. That just hasn't happened. They've turned their attention to next season already.
But how good was Jenson Button in Germany?
Yes.
That's their one glimmer of hope, is that... When then their rivals struggle, as Force India seems to have been hit, maybe not as hard as Mercedes, but still pretty hard from this tyre change. You know, that hit them harder than, say, Lotus, who sort of... You had two teams which were Lotus and Force India, who both excelled in the same conditions. And yet, in conditions that should have favoured both of those teams in Germany, Force India fell back, yet Lotus didn't. And so you'd have to suggest that the changes Pirelli have made have thus far... hurt Force India. There are more changes to come, so you know there's still the order is going to be shuffled some more. But it's essentially, when Force India don't do so well, and when Mercedes struggle also, McLaren have a chance to salvage their reputation and some points.
Yeah, I mean, Force India, well, Paul de Resta in particular, has been doing a pretty consistent job so far. He's out of the 9 races we've had so far, he's retired from one, and then he finished in Germany just outside the points in 11th. But all the rest, he's picked up points. Now, they may not be massively high positions. The 4th in Bahrain is his best. But, you know, points every time that they're gonna rack up. And McLaren just don't have anything to give back to that. But Jenson Button, he was quoted as saying that he's not thinking of leaving the team. He said, "This isn't a team that is finishing 4th or 5th in the constructors. This is a bad year, and in years to come, this team will be fighting for world championships. I'm not looking around like some people might think." Well, we know that Button knows how to deal with a really bad car. He's done that.
Mm-hmm.
He knows how to bide his time and stick with it. So do we think that at some point in the future he's going to rocket to the top and do a Brawn-esque championship win?
I don't know. I'll tell you what I will mention, actually, is a discussion we had offline earlier on in the week, and I saw a picture of Jensen and Martin Whitmarsh in conversation, and it sort of dawned on me that I could see Jensen running McLaren long time in the future. If you're thinking like 20 years time, I could see Jensen position himself to be a big cog in the McLaren wheel.
I
don't think it hadn't occurred to me that he might even be considering leaving McLaren. I don't for one second think that's going to happen. I don't know who's been suggesting that. I think that's crazy. I definitely think he'll stay. I definitely think McLaren will be much faster in 2 years' time if he's still there. And then I wouldn't be surprised to see him go into some kind of managerial position. And I think it'll be brilliant as some kind of upper management in McLaren.
He definitely gets on with everyone. He definitely gets on with Martin Whitmarsh.
He's a people person.
He is incredible in front of the camera and in front of, on stage, in front of lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
He's amazing. I mean, that's, I think a lot of people predict he would go into broadcasting afterwards because he's so comfortable presenting and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think that he's going to take over a team, is it really going to be McLaren? Because he doesn't strike me as the Ron Dennis type. And with McLaren, you have to have the spotless flaws.
True. I don't know. I just think that if you had a choice, if your Formula One career was coming to an end and you could go and be the next David Coulthard on the BBC or the next Martin Brundle on Sky, or you could be the next Martin Whitmarsh and run your team, your own team, or run, a large and prestigious team in Formula One, that would be my choice. And stuff the media spotlight, stuff commentating on races for a living, that would be what I'd be looking at. And, you know, I have no evidence at all to back this up. I genuinely saw one picture and thought, yeah, that's interesting. He
was
just like,
smiling.
I genuinely, if I didn't know he was a race driver, I would have said he was in charge of the team. The way he was carrying himself in the picture. And, you know, there's nothing to back that up. I'm, you know, whatever. I'm just saying.
Another team that are struggling this year is Sauber. They're having a terrible time. They've got 7 points out of the year so far. And there are rumours swirling around about the money troubles and some people not get paid or something.
Peter Sauber said everybody has gotten paid and he's never not paid anyone. I think that's what he said. I may be misquoting him, but that was the gist I got from the conversation. But there is there are question marks over whether Hülkenberg, whether his contract has been ripped up due to some forfeit or other by Sauber, in which case he's there because he hasn't got anywhere else to go, effectively.
But he could leave if he wanted to. Well, I don't think it's very nice on poor Manisha. She said, "We have very openly said this is a difficult time for us, but we are doing all we can to come out of this situation. We have entered for this season and we have at no stage doubted that we will not be there this season." Who is making all these rumours that Button's going to leave McLaren and Sauber aren't going to see the end of the season? I haven't seen any of these, but suddenly people are having to defend themselves all the time.
You know why we don't read about Formula One on the internet? Because most of what's written about Formula One on the internet is rubbish. And therefore, whenever these rumours come up, whenever people defend rubbish these rumours, we never heard the rumours in the first place. But you can see that Sauber have been in a precarious position since BMW left. No doubt about that.
I thought it showed quite a significant problem when they were so excited about a partnership with Chelsea, when that doesn't bring them any money at all.
No, but it opens the conversation between them and whoever the rich guy is who owns Chelsea.
Right.
Whose name I've forgotten, but the guy who funds that team has very deep pockets. So that's quite interesting. But Sauber have been struggling with finances. They've lost key personnel, and they've managed this year to create a car that isn't as fast as, well, certainly as fast as last year's chassis. They're in the same position as Williams. They're a team on a really small budget. They have to punch above their weight, essentially at all times, in order to keep themselves in the spotlight. And when they fall from that position, then it's hard to get themselves noticed, and then they struggle. Williams in the same, you know, exactly the same boat.
Yes, well, Williams, I mean, Claire Williams just sort of, well, she's essentially taken over. She's deputy team principal, but she's the face of Williams now at this point. And all she does is say how much work they have to do and how they're not fazed by it. We're going to do this work. We're going to get back up there. That's all. Any time I see her talking, it's like, yes, we know there's work to do.
Because they're on the defensive. Because we've gone 2 seasons now with almost static regulations. And therefore, teams who have fast cars from one year, you know, in the first year, should have a fast car in the second year. And bizarrely, both Williams and Sauber managed to lose performance over the winter inexplicably. Yes. Because they didn't have to. I mean, McLaren are another team who did it too. But none of those teams actually were expected to lose that much performance because they knew how to make a fast car and the regulations didn't change.
3 people this season will be laughing on a smug face about what's happened this year. 1, Lewis Hamilton, obviously, because he's departed from McLaren. Everyone said it was a bad move and seems like it's worked out okay for him.
Absolutely the right call.
Toto Wolff.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was like, what are you doing leaving a guaranteed amazing director position at Williams?
Yep.
Well, that's worked out quite well.
Has too,
for him. And, the opposite is Hülkenberg. So Paul de Resta has the smug face because he's left behind. He was quite grumpy about it, as we have mentioned many times.
Yes.
And he's looking at Nico Hülkenberg, who made that move, and it didn't really
hasn't
work
even got,
out.
He potentially, allegedly hasn't got paid. At least Paul de Resta is getting paid. I'll tell you what, at the beginning of this year, if somebody has said to you that Hülkenberg wouldn't get paid, but Paul de Resta would be just sound as a pound, he'd be getting his own sponsorship and his own cap.
He wears a hat now.
You wouldn't have believed it, would you? I mean, Force India are in the most...
I still don't understand how they're still running in business.
No, I don't either. I don't either. But at least the people who are in charge of Force India have some money. The problem with Sauber is effectively they have no sponsors and they have no investor. So they've got no money at all.
And they have no results to entice anyone.
That's exactly the problem. One point from last weekend was nice, but it wasn't enough. I think had the safety car not come out when it did, they may have been in a better position than they finally were, which is a shame. But that's racing.
That's racing, and that's what happens when you're relying on luck instead of having anything to back it up with.
Indeed, and the same can be said for Grosjean, who it has to be. I've got to mention. I mean, we've talked about him already, but it's come back to me how damn good Romain Grosjean's open incident was on soft tyres.
Yeah,
which was probably, that may well be one of the highlights of my season. Fernando Alonso played a strategy card in qualifying, which saw him not bother to really qualify on the harder set of tyres, so that they would go long into the race and he could skip the problem of traffic. So you don't want to pit too early. You go long on your medium tyres. You make sure you're in a prime position when you pit. You've got clear air in front of you, and off you go, and there goes your race strategy. And that didn't happen. Fernando Alonso didn't run that many more laps than the drivers in front of him who had qualified well on the softer tyre. But bizarrely, Grosjean on the softer tyre, the tyre that should see him pitting very early, he went longer than Fernando Alonso and faster. He didn't lose any performance. He gained performance on the worst tyre. And I don't know how that Lotus chassis is set up or how he managed to do it. But that, to me, was an incredible drive. And had the safety car not come out when it did, Grosjean could have been, if Grosjean had made the strategy that he was making work before the safety car had come out, if he continued that into the race, could have been looking at a Grosjean win. That's not beyond the realms of possibility.
You know, if that happened,
look at Grosjean's open incident again and tell me that if he kept that up, now perhaps when the car, when the fuel came out of the car, the performance would have dropped off anyway. Maybe the safety car was just a coincidence, but had that happened, it could have been a really good race for him.
If he'd have won, I think I would have had to capitulate and have an International Day of Grosjean.
Really? Okay. Well, you never know, because the safety car came out because of Bianchi and his lack of... Did we decide it was Bianchi's fault? He didn't put it in gear in the end? It was him.
Oh, I love the rogue Marussia.
Really?
I mean, it could have been really dangerous, and I know that, but just watching the car just drifting backwards. Oh, that was... Once you know that it's safe, that was fun.
That was, yeah. It doesn't happen that often. It's been a long time since we've seen that, largely because most of the places we go racing now are flat as a pancake.
Yeah.
But in Germany, you have the undulation. It's built on the side of a mountain. The Marussia went off a race of its own.
Off itself.
It did.
Brilliant.
And it was, you have the marshals running after it, and Benny Hill style. Hilarious. Genius.
That race, I just thought we'd mention that we do rate the race after each event, after each weekend. We put up a post with the ability to rate the race out of 5 stars, and that one got 3.83 stars.
Can but you down the middle.
0.83 of a star, I don't know. But that, yeah.
That's at this point. I mean, the polls are still open. You can still vote if you listen to the show within a reasonable time frame after we put it out. You can still vote. So you can still change that, but it's not the highest rated race of the season. It was a good one. It was a very good one, but it was lacking in significant events. I think it was lacking in something, a real wow factor.
The significant events were all worrying. That's the thing, isn't it? You had road cars and people getting hurt by wheels. So that has to tide us over for 3 weeks, because stupid first half of the calendar. We've got one
stupid first half. You're not a fan of the way that this calendar's panning out.
One more race in the next 7 weeks or something, and then it's just manic. Once the summer break is gone and the second half begins, it's just, there's 3 races in September and 3 races in October, or is it October and November? Either way, there's 6 races in 2 months, and I just
don't make any plans. Don't make any plans at all. What you don't want to do with that kind of high pressure situation in the calendar is go ahead and start a new pre-race podcast. That would be a really dumb thing to do. Who would do a thing like that, Christine?
It's not new. It's
new.
The return of F1 Digest. If you are a long time Side Podcast listener, you may have heard of F1 Digest before. I think it was perhaps ahead of 2010 that the last show appeared, and it was coverage of a race weekend. Now it is one show on a race weekend. It's a preview to the event with all the things you need to know, like the weather and who's feeling good about it and how the championship's stacking up and what the circuit is like. It's about a 10-minute show, leads you into the weekend nicely. And that's going to be a bit of a hard work.
It's going to keep you busy. Mind you, with 7 weeks of no racing. I'm guessing that gives you plenty of time to bring forth another mini series. That's a lot of free time, isn't that? That's a lot of Christine time coming up.
There was a mini series recently that actually went down surprisingly well. I've always enjoyed the mini series because it's just 7 short shows, one each day for a week, so it has a finite amount, and they cover all sorts of topics like teams and circuits. And this time it was racing families, so all the drivers that are related to other drivers and how these things seem to get passed along in the DNA. And one thing we noticed with this one was that people really, really like to guess what is coming up or mm-hmm. make suggestions about the future episodes, which I hadn't really noticed in previous series quite so much. But people like talking about the families that are racing.
You've got a lot of suggestions for a second series.
I do. I'm just going to have to do that.
That'll keep you busy.
It's also worth noting that one of those shows was about the Hill family. Damon Hill and mm-hmm. Graham Hill and Josh Hill, who just recently announced he's giving up. So I got that one in just in time.
He is. I'm curious there where the what happened, because
he said he wants to do something else. Well, my guess is that, I mean, he wanted to continue. I think what they said on his website that it was in big bold letters, I want to be the first to be the third generation champion. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was happening. I don't think it was going where he wanted to go. And if he knew he couldn't do that, would you really want to just be a subpar third generation?
I guess he didn't. Yeah, I guess there wasn't.
He's going to do something else.
Well, I wonder what he's going to do. I mean, you've got Argus Warris. He's you know, DJ Squire. DJ. Maybe he's going to go down that route.
Grosjean worked in a bank.
Yeah. Any other professions?
Well, Button is apparently going to be a team boss.
Yeah, that's a traditional.
There's lots of options open for him. It's not just me doing all this hard work. On the site, though, we have excellent features. They're still coming in. The writers are still amazing, particularly Chainbear. He's had some amusing cartoons.
Chainbear is becoming a bit of a legend.
Really?
I was looking at some stats the other day. Chainbear is in danger of being more popular than Joe on the site. There are more people looking at Chainbear's cartoons than anything else on Side Podcast. It's incredible the number of people, the appeal, the scale and breadth of his appeal of his cartoons.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, they're excellent. Secondly, it's not something you get very many other places. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, because they're nice and they're quick and they're snappy and they're funny, so you can read them and take them away. And some of those pictures will live with me forever. They're brilliant.
You cannot unsee exactly. A Chainbear cartoon.
But also Adam, as I think you mentioned him earlier, he does great sort of driver of the day reviews.
Do you know what? I look forward to that so much now.
Yeah.
One of the highlights after you have the race weekend, and we do the rate the race poll, and I'm always thinking, like, after, you know, okay, yeah, I'll give that race a 3, and you know, I thought that driver did well. I wonder what Adam thought.
Yeah, who's Adam?
I wonder what, because, like, there wasn't really any standout drives on Sunday, and I thought, you know, I wouldn't want to be writing the class of the field column.
He always finds something.
But no, he did. He found some good drives. A very good read. Highly recommend that one. And Will is another prolific writer.
We have to give a shout out to Will because he writes some amazing technical wizardry stuff, and I can't promise that I understand every word.
I do love watching you and listening to you sub edit a post from Will,
but I do enjoy them anyway.
You don't have to sound confused when you're proofreading it and checking it and prepping the post for publication.
Yeah,
it's most amusing. One day I may actually film you doing that.
No, don't do that. But they are very good and really in-depth topics as well, so I think it's really worth a read if you have some time on your hands. And if you do, go to sidepodcast.com/features to check out all the latest work.
Do that. Just do that right now. If you're listening to the show and wherever you are, make a note. If you haven't got a device or any means of checking Side Podcast, if you're listening offline or whatever, make a note to the next time that you go online, sidepodcast.com/features. It's a definite Side Podcast highlight. It's not only is it just, it's the best thing on Side Podcast, but it's one of the best things, one of the best F1 things on the whole of the internet.
And have you seen the whole of the internet? Can you really make
I've seen the whole of... I've seen everything F1 related on the internet, and it's better than all of it.
Okay.
And you know, I can say that because I don't have a column. So I'm not bigging myself up there at all. It's the writing is exemplary. Cartoons are fabulous. It's just brilliant. I love it. And I encourage anybody who hasn't spent some time reading back on-site podcast features, do so. A lot of them are really timeless. I mean, you can go back, you know, go back this year, last year. Lots of them aren't, they aren't massively time sensitive. So you, definitely worth a read. Even if you're just listening in now and you need to catch up, feel free to trawl the features archives.
As I briefly mentioned, there is one race in the next seven-ish weeks, because the summer break is rapidly approaching, and that is 4 weeks of no Formula One.
Mm.
And if the weather's anything like it would be at the moment, we should probably go on holiday. But if it's not, we need to find a way to entertain the troops.
And you have just that means, don't you?
Well, I don't know. This idea popped into my head, and it's probably stupid, and it's probably going to come to nothing. But I just thought, what about this? I walked in the room and said to you, what if we could do a side podcast summer camp? And you laughed a lot, and then you tweeted it, and everyone else laughed as well.
Mm.
And it is a ridiculous idea, but I just thought maybe it, if you made it a virtual summer camp kind of thing. I mean, what are summer camps? They are places people go in the summer to hang out, to learn things, to do different activities. Now, we could do that online. We could have a different activity every day, or, you know, a side pod film watch, or all the things that we've done, but just, you know, to keep people entertained. And then Giggles, Alex, came up with the idea that we need side podcast camp counsellors.
Which I, at this point, I should put out my hand, I laughed at your concept of a summer camp, because I don't actually really know what a summer camp is. It's an American thing, right?
It is primarily an American thing. They do it in the UK, but it's not a big thing here.
What is a camp counsellor?
They are the people that look after the kids that go on camp. You know, the adults.
All right, okay.
So they instruct them and take them on the activities and make sure that they're not getting into trouble. So at the moment, it's just an idea, something we could do. It's the kind of thing that needs a lot of audience participation,
mm-hmm.
A bit of collaboration.
How many weeks is this side podcast camp going to last?
One or two.
Okay, so not going to span the entire four-week summer break.
No.
It's like a two-week holiday away.
A two-week camp.
In the cloud.
Yes. So, it's just an idea. I thought I would put it out there and see if anyone had any genius suggestions. I'm sure that we can make it work somehow. And
the idea would be you turn up to Side Podcast of an evening when you get home from work or whenever. You check in the Side Podcast and you see what the day's activities might be.
Yeah.
And then you participate if you feel like it. And sometimes you skive off to the pub.
Yes.
That's roughly how it works, right?
Okay, yes.
Okay. Suggestions in the comments?
Absolutely.
Or Twitter. Good stuff. That must be us wrapped, because we've been talking for an hour and 20 minutes. And I am, frankly, melting in this seat. I think we've covered Formula One. I think we've basically put the world to rights.
We've done it for now until the next big thing happens, explodes, tyres.
Well, we'll see what happens in testing. We will learn who's come out on top. We'll go to Hungary.
We're going to Hungary?
Hypothetically speaking.
Oh, okay. Like the hypothetical summer camp.
Yes. We will watch the Hungarian Grand Prix from the comfort of our couch. And we'll see if the changes that Pirelli are bringing mix up the order anymore. And then we'll see what the remainder of the season brings. I am very much enjoying this Formula One season, and I do apologise we haven't done more shows. We have been a bit busy. We've actually done an awful lot of shows. We've just not done any shows together.
That's interesting. I've been doing my stuff, and you've been talking to Joe, and somehow we haven't met in the middle.
We've put out a lot of podcasts. We've got a lot of downloads. So much content has been downloaded. So many listeners. So many new listeners. So podcast is growing every day. It's amazing the growth of this site. It never ceases to baffle me, really, because we always expect little from the site, and it always delivers more and more. But we're talking, you know, we've discussed the Formula One world, and we've sorted everything out, and now people just have to listen to us and fix everything. That'll be great.
We're still here. We're loving F1, and we love all of you.